Why, hello and welcome. Welcome to the Peer Pressure Podcast. I am Diane, sometimes known as Diane Kamikaze, and I am your host. The reason why I do this podcast is because I like to say I am a champion of heavy music. I've always found my favorite songs since I was a young kid had riffs, hooks, were either metal, hardcore, hard rock, or punk, or something fairly aggressive in attitude and sound. And I am all about appreciating the people that keep that world going, whether they're musicians, webmasters, other podcasters, record label and festival owners. It's important to me to recognize what these people do in that realm of music. So, I am here to bring them to you in a different context, more than a Wikipedia entry or a press release, a little more personal and a lot more fun. I'm a rocker for life, and I hope these episodes do make a difference. Send me feedback at diane@wfmu.org, and my Facebook page is Diane Kamikaze Farris, Rocker for Life. Like my page there, and I will keep everybody updated on podcast episodes in that space. Thanks so much for listening, and stay tuned. And my guest today is Hugo Burnham, the outstanding drummer from Gang of Four. So talented. This was from September 13th, 2012. It was a regular radio show, and he's got a couple of sets of music that he provided too, which was great. I would recommend going back to that original playlist. He'll tell you about growing up in the south of England, and so just stay tuned. Some archives here for you on Peer Pressure. My guest is Hugo Burnham. Hugo, are you there?
I am there.
You are there. You are there. And you are here. Oh, I'm so excited. Yay. Well, thank you for coming on the show.
You're very welcome, Diane.
So what's been going on since 1983?
Your show's not long enough. In a nutshell, since I left Gang of Four, I spent a year or two as a session musician, and then I went into artist management, working with, among others, Shriekback and Neil Arthur from Blancmange and a little bit with Julian Cope. I moved from London to New York City because the first time I got there in 1979, in June of 79, I just like, whoa, this is good. This is better than it looks on Kojak. I think I'll have to live here one day. So I did. I moved there in 1988 and actually ended up working for Island Records doing A&R, which was fantastic. It was a really great place. I was there for a couple of years, and then I went from there to a company called Imago Records, working with a lot of acts, new acts, and Henry Rollins and people like that. And in 91, they sent me out to Los Angeles to open up and run their West Coast office, which I did for a while. And then I went from there to Quest Records, which is Quincy Jones's label, over at Warner Brothers, which is great because Gang of Four had been signed to Warners, and I knew a lot of the people there. It's good to work with them again. I was with Quincy for 3 years. Then I went to EMI Publishing in L.A. Then I moved back to the East Coast. My wife was a publicist in the business with a number of labels, and was both of us were feeling pretty burned out and getting bored with it all. I think she'd had enough of musicians. Not drummers, but musicians. I sort of fell into teaching. I'm an associate professor at the New England Institute of Art now in Boston.
That's awesome.
There's 20-odd years in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect.
And we have a 12-year-old daughter.
Oh.
And we live up on the North Shore, just about 40 miles outside Boston.
Very good.
Well, 12. I think she's 12. She might be 20. I'm never sure some days.
Ah, that does happen with those children. Was your trip to the U.S. with Gang of Four the first time you'd been in New York?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was my first trip to the U.S. Mm. John and Andrew had been to New York a couple of years before. They got a grant from Leeds University Art Department to go and study medieval architecture in Europe, and went to New York and hung out at CBGB's on the grant.
Wait, and that's that qualifies as medieval architecture?
Yeah, clearly.
CBGBs.
If you've ever been in there, you'd know.
Yes.
It certainly smelled like medieval.
Right. What did you expect when you came to New York, and how did it compare to the audiences? Well, how did your U.S. trips compare to what we're used to in the U.K.?
I don't know. Everyone just loved it and drank a lot and made lots of noise and screamed and danced and shouted. It was all very good. I think when we first came to the States, there was a lot of reaction at first was, I think people were very surprised by the ferocity and aggression of the way we played. I think they were expecting something a little more shoegazing and a little more self-absorbed and serious. I mean, we were serious, but I think we were louder and more full of energy than they might have been expecting. And surprised, as in very pleasantly surprised, obviously.
Oh, yeah, sure. I do remember I saw you guys at Irving Plaza whenever that was in the 80s. But I think that I knew, I really expected a real bulldoze kind of effect.
Oh, yeah, we bulldozed.
Yes, you did. That was just one of the most stellar things I'd ever seen.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you. So I just played the version of Damaged Goods that's on the Fast Product record, the Mutant Pop.
Yep.
How did that record come about?
Well, our very good and dear friends, the Mekons, ended up getting a show opening for a band called the Rizzillos, who had a couple of great hits at the time in England. That was in Leeds, and it was at the F Club or something. And the Rizzillos loved them, and their manager said, "Oh, you should come and make a record with us. We got a little label with us. You should do it." And they all said, "Are you mad? You want the Gang of Four, not us. They're the real band." So the Mekons were the first record on Fast Product. And I think the Scars and then the Human League and then Bob Last gave in to all the pressure, and Gang of Four did a record with him. And that Damaged Goods EP that also had Love Like Anthrax and Arm Like Rifle on it, that really became the calling card that got us the sort of a huge jump in attention, leading to our record deals with, our record deal with Warner, with EMI in London for the rest of the world. And we didn't sign for America. We came to tour right after we'd recorded Entertainment in early 79, and we came out on a tour that we sort of self-financed ourselves off the back of, well, not the money we earned from, we didn't earn a penny from the EP, but it was self-financed. Ian Copeland of FBI.
Oh, yeah.
Over, and we did 4 or 5 weeks. Six of those shows were opening for the Buzzcocks, who were on their first U.S. tour. Just six of us came, from the band, our manager Rob, my brother Julian, as the crew guy. You know, we shared beds and worked our way around the country, and that got us our deal with Warner Brothers. And so Entertainment was then released in January of 1980 in the United States.
You said that the Fast Product was put out by Bob Last, who was the Rizzillo's manager, right?
Yeah.
Why weren't the Rizzillo's on the record?
Why weren't they on that label?
On the compilation.
Oh, because they were signed to another. They were signed to another label,
proper label.
Oh, I think cool. It was just their money that paid for Fast Product. They said, let's have a little indie label.
Oh, how nice!
It's a bit like Stiff Records was started by Jake Rivera, who managed Dr. Feelgood, who, the probably apocryphal story is, he borrowed £500 from their tour account to start the label.
Well, however it had to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's super. So what's the age difference between you and your brother?
My brother's younger than me, but he and actually Dave Allen, bass player's younger brother, Phil, they were our original crew, both of them.
Yeah, because you thank your brother on your records.
Yep. Yeah, I think he's highly insulted listening to this now.
Come on.
He shouldn't be. I'm much better looking than he is, and thinner.
So you said that the Mekons were the ones who sort of pulled you onto that label, and I know we'll be talking about them later, but what is that love affair between Gang of Four and the Mekons? You thank Mekons on your record, and they've got a picture of Gang of Four on their record.
Well, basically, before the band started, we were all just friends, just all centered around the fine art department at Leeds University. I wasn't in that department, but, we were just a bunch of friends, many of whom had actually all been to school together, high school in Sevenoaks in Kent in the south of England. And I went to high school just a few miles from there, but I didn't know them until we got to Leeds. So when Gang of Four sort of started, those that became the Mekons, just our friends hanging out in the rehearsal space. And when we went off to, you know, when we stopped to go and get a beer or something, which was fairly frequently, they'd sort of jump up and become the Mekons. And that's how it started. So, you know, we shared rehearsal space forever, and with Delta 5 as well. And we actually built a PA system together.
Oh, wow.
Shared everything pretty much. So, yep.
You know, as an outsider, it just looks so cute. It's like, oh, thanks to Mekons. You know,
yeah, and well, yeah, Mekons are very cute.
You were part of the entire band did reunite for the 2004 reunion. How did that come about?
Well, specifically, we started in 2005, but we got together in the summer of 2004 because, you know, the idea had sort of raised its head a number of times, a couple of years before that, but, you know, as most bands do, things have not ended terribly well sometimes. I don't think John and Andrew had spoken to Dave since he left the band. Although, actually, I got Andrew and Dave together for a dinner in Los Angeles when Dave and I were living out there. Andrew was out. I think he was producing, I can't remember. Anyway, he was producing someone at work. We went and had dinner. And it was good. I mean, it was pleasant. You know, Andrew stuck his tongue down Dave's wife's throat and that sort of thing. It was all very, very, very charming. But we were sort of said, well, come over and let's talk about this. John and Andrew expressed an interest. And I'd seen them in the summer and they said, well, maybe we could do this if we do it properly. So Dave and I went over and we all had a meeting. It was a little bit fraught at the beginning. There was a manager involved who half of us weren't exactly sure about, but just went with it. But very quickly, after some sort of silly machinations by that manager about publishing were tried and wrestled to the floor and stomped on, we just started talking about music instead of business, and it got, we all just fired back up again. And we went back to Andrew's house and drank and talked more. And, you know, I just thought, well, I know we can do this. But I think the main thing was, we all still had our hair, and I think without that, we would have been really rather obscene to have tried it. So
that was,
yeah, we did it, and you know, and then it required quite a lot of, you know, that was, God, that was September, October, probably. So I came back, and I mean, I hadn't really played for years. I know that the other three had, or certainly Dave and Andrew had been playing fairly regularly. So I booked a rehearsal room here, just outside Boston, and went in and played along to the CD for a couple of weeks to Entertainment and Solid Gold, and I tell you, the first week was torture. I couldn't believe how fast we used to play.
Yeah.
And, it's one thing when you're 23 to do this, but when you're turning 50, it's a whole thing, another thing entirely. And trust me, I wept. And then it started clicking in after a while, and felt much more confident about it. And with severe and fabulous encouragement from Carol, my wife, who said, you can do this just as well as they can. Despite calls from this holy assholic manager telling me, well, you're not very good. You're practicing and they don't think you can do it.
What?
Dreadful little man. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Yeah.
Dave and I flew over in the new year of January 2005. We spent 5 days rehearsing in Andrew's studio and we went on tour.
Wow. So 5 days of rehearsal together.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty amazing.
Well, yes, it was. We were.
And when did you start drumming? At what age did you start drumming?
Oh, good God. I played a snare drum in the school orchestra when I was 11 at my prep school. And then when I was, I think, 14, I convinced my dad to let me have all the money that I'd been saving up from my birthdays and Christmases over the years, and I went up to Charing Cross Road, where all the music stores were in London, and I'd found an Olympic drum kit, a used Olympic drum kit there, and bought it. And I had, played it in the shed at the side of the house, playing along to Creedence Clearwater Revival records and Free records, and then got a school band together. And then I actually sold my kit when I had to do my last year of high school to get my A-levels. I was trying to be good at that. But, and then I didn't really play again until
Gang of Four started, really.
I mean, I just said that, you know, we're all going to get a band together doing this. I said, well, I play drums. Where's your drum kit then? At home, but I'll get another one. So I did, and it's just basically, we went from there.
You mentioned Creedence and Free. So you were drumming to those records to sort of start learning?
Yeah, I mean, that was some of the stuff I was listening to at the time. I mean, Creedence Clearwater Revival was actually the first band I ever saw live. In 1970, I think it was, they came to London and played at the Royal Albert Hall. And my dad took my brother Jolyon and I to see it, and we were sort of way upstairs somewhere, but it was magic. It was so exciting. And then the second live gig I ever went to was about 9 months later, the same band in the same venue, except this time it was a threesome because Tom Fogerty had left the band.
Oh, right.
And I went on my own, which was very exciting. And so I sort of got downstairs and went, just basically hung out at the front of the stage.
Did you go to a lot of shows when you were growing up?
Were
you...
Yeah, I did, actually. I mean, it sort of started a lot from there. And we used to, my friends and I, used to go and see Hawkwind a lot. Used to follow them all around the southeast.
Oh, wow.
Bands like Stackridge and Thomas. And we also put on bands at my high school. I was involved in booking some of them. We had Genesis. We paid like £100 for right after Nursery Crime came out.
Wow, really?
We had Barclay James Harvest, we had the Pink Fairies, and that was quite the experience, you know, and stuff like that. And I actually went to quite a lot of early, like, sort of, all the glitter scene stuff. I saw David Bowie at the Rainbow about a month after Ziggy Stardust came out, before everything really took off. Roxy Music were opening for him, and the Lindsay Kemp dance troupe were part of the show, and it was just... Oh, I mean, it was about 3 weeks after he'd been on Top of the Pops doing Starman. Top of the Pops was just about the only weekly charts music show in England that we'd all grown up with. And you'll find a lot of people of my sort of generation, musicians, who quote that as being the evening that changed their lives. So,
wow.
That was great. So, yeah, I saw a lot of shows. And then when I went to Leeds... Leeds was one of the big stops on the tours for many big bands, Leeds University. I mean, that's where the Who recorded live at Leeds there. But I mean, my first term, I saw Bob Marley, I saw Lynyrd Skynyrd, Leo Sayer. I just went to everything, you know. The Sex Pistols Anarchy tour came to Leeds, Polly just down the road, so we all saw that. The Heartbreakers and The Clash and The Damned all on the same bill.
Especially being... in the UK, what was that first wave of punk like for you?
Oh, it's great. I mean, you know, it was exciting. It was like, you know, it sort of, there was definitely strings, tentacles coming back from sort of whole glitter thing, the Bowies and the Roxies and all that, and also very much from the pub rock thing. I mean, anyone who liked Dr. Fielded probably moved on very easily to punk rock. But I don't know, it's just that time in your life where sort of almost anything that you can find and go and see that's interesting and that's in the NME, the New Musical Express, you've got to check it out. You've got to go and see it. It's just fun and exciting, and it upset people, so they must have been doing something right.
Yeah. Well, so you were there. You were in the middle of it.
Pretty much.
Yeah. From this end, we were reading about the things happening in the NME, and, of course, the U.S. had its own... explosion, and you know, you always wonder what it's like when that stuff really first starts.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, you know, again, being in Leeds, we saw, you know, first tours, you know, the Ramones and Talking Heads, Blondie, all that stuff. You know, they'd all come, and Leeds Uni or Leeds Poly were always a stop on any of those tours. So we were really lucky getting to see all those acts the first time they came.
Yeah, how
very... Talking Heads and Ramones were the double bill the first time, I think.
Wow. Well, that ended a little abruptly, and there was an issue with the original file. But so at least 15 minutes of Hugo is better than nothing. I loved hearing about what it was like in southern England. I'll be approaching other shows for archives, and drop me a line, diane@wfmu.org, if you have any requests from my old playlists. And as always, thank you so much for listening and for supporting WFMU. And that concludes another podcast episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. More on the way. I am Diane Kamikaze, and my Instagram handle is one word, Diane Kamikaze. Kamikaze ends with an E. On Facebook, you can find me as Diane Kamikaze Farris, Rocker for Life and Making a Difference. The full link to my index of shows and podcasts can be found on wfmu.org/playlists/DK. That's a capital D and a capital K. I'm going to be working on encore presentations, and I've got years of interviews and podcasts. So if there's something that you'd like to see reposted that you missed, please get in touch. And be sure to subscribe to the show. And if you like it, please rate it and review it. Wow. WFMU. Peer pressure. Thank you. See you next time.